Hi, everyone. Thank you for coming. The title of my talk is When Knowledge Clashes with Judgment, Black Men's Subjective Assessments of HIV Risk in Prospective Male Partners. And I have no financial disclosures, nothing to disclose. A little bit of what we all know already. Black MSM are one of the highest, one of the groups at highest risk for HIV infection in the country. And currently, there are very few evidence-based interventions for this population. And many of the prevention interventions are very cognitive-based, and they're focused on sharing information and knowledge. But despite this, my research will show that, you know, despite having this knowledge, men don't necessarily act on it. The research I did was focused in Providence, Rhode Island. Rhode Island's a lovely little state. It's very small, second most densely populated state in the country. Black men and women make up 5% of the population, but 25% of the AIDS cases as of 2008. And reflecting national data, MSM are the highest exposure group in Rhode Island. With black MSM accounting for 16% of HIV-infected MSM from 2000 to 2008. And in Providence, 85% of all cases of HIV/AIDS in Rhode Island occur in Providence, Rhode Island, the setting of my research. So what we did was we did semi-structured interviews from October 2009 to March 2011 in Providence. Based at a Brown University, and our sample was 34 black MSM, and we recruited them from a variety of methods. We used electronic virtual media, so a lot of posting on listservs, on hookup websites, MSM-themed spaces such as bathhouses, general public places like street corners, restaurants, farmers markets, and a couple of key informants that were very valuable. The reason we decided to do qualitative methods was there is a lot of quantitative stuff out there, and we thought that giving voices to these men might help to nuance the data that is already out there and provide a deeper meaning for the behaviors that we're observing. So the inclusion criteria for the study was 18 years of age or older. They had to self-identify as black or African American. And they had to have engaged in unprotected sex with a man within the past 12 months. So one episode of unprotected sex and one episode of protected sex within the past 12 months. And there's no exclusion based on their HIV status. And the demographic profile of our subjects was we had about 59% that identified as gay and 18% as bisexual. And 71% were MSM. We didn't exclude if the men were also sleeping with women or had slept with women in the past 12 months. They were not excluded, and that made up about 29% of the sample. And the data was split up roughly into half by people that had completed high school versus had not completed high school, and or had completed high school versus an education beyond high school. And 56% of the sample were unemployed, and of the 44% that were employed, a lot of it was part-time work, intermittent, not necessarily enough to sustain themselves. And 21% of the sample reported being HIV positive. So again, the objectives of the study was to understand the subjective lived experiences of black MSM in Providence, Rhode Island, and to examine the social context in which their decisions to engage in protected sex versus unprotected sex were, and to describe these factors basically in their own voices. And so we basically contrasted the two episodes. We asked men to describe one time that the most recent episode of unprotected sex and the situational context of that episode, where they had sex, where they met their partner, were their family members around, how were they feeling at the time, and we contrasted that with similar questions about a previous episode of protected sex, the most recent, with a man, not a woman. And so what we found was men's risk assessment generally fell into a two-step process. The first being they would use perceptible cues to ascertain a partner's sexual status, whether they were HIV positive or not, and how comfortable they felt in sleeping with that partner. And once that was done, they would move to assess whether that partner they believed was safe. And if in the first step they believed that the partner was safe, they would try and decide, well, am I going to sleep with him with a condom, without a condom, or not sleep with him at all? And so we found four major categories of risk assessment. One was the participants describing whether they believed someone was positive or negative based on their intuition, a gut feeling. Another was visual perceptions. The third was location-based cues. And finally, behavioral cues from their partner. So the first condom intuition, condom use decisions and behaviors were guided by what sense participants got from their partners, and how they felt about how trustworthy their partner was or how responsible they believed that partner to be. So one of the quotes a participant made was, "I don't know, it's just the way I feel." And this is what he used to guide whether he would sleep with the participant. And in this case, he did sleep with the participant. He didn't know he did not know what the partner's status was, but he got a sense that the partner was safe. And another participant said, "Depends on the mood, on the feeling I'm getting from the other guy. He was intense. Even though the guy 2 months ago was persistent, the other guy was really intense and kept going after it, which led me to think, what makes me that special that he would pursue me so strongly? Is he like this with everybody? And if so, what are the chances that he wouldn't have something?" In this case, the participant's gut intuition led him to not have sex with that particular partner. The second based category of risk assessment was based on visual perceptions. Participants considering hygiene, grooming, cleanliness, and that guided their decisions on whether they would sleep with the partner or not. Clean, well-kept partners were perceived as safe. Poorly groomed partners were perceived as being possibly unsafe. So the visual cues specifically that they looked for or the participants described were clean, well-manicured fingernails, pleasant body odor, absence of any sores or scabs, and cleanliness of their homes. And if they saw these, the participants that did describe these cues would then say, this person keeps themselves clean, so chances are they are clean, so to speak. One participant said, "The guy 2 months ago seemed like a clean-cut guy. He seemed like he was pretty clean, but the other guy was grimy, rough, dirty kind of guy, and that kind of thing." This led the participant to not want to have sex with this prospective partner. Another participant said, "I can tell he's clean because by his smell, and I say I feel that between a male and a female, a man sweats. It has a more stronger scent than a woman. And when I smell him, he keeps his body clean, and he's, I can just look at him and I can tell he's clean because he has a nice body, he's built." A third participant said, "Oh no, I was definitely grilling," as in questioning the partner. "I've challenged their responses and I asked questions. They looked clean, they seemed like the type of people that would look after themselves." So this participant was very well versed in HIV prevention information. But he still fell back on visual cues when trying to decide whether to sleep with this participant, with this partner, and he did in this case. And finally, "His house is clean, he keeps himself clean, showers and stuff, then he goes out and gets pedicures." So this is another example. The third category of risk assessment was location-based risk assessment. This had a lot to do with where participants described meeting their partners. If they met their partners at high-risk venues, such as a bathhouse or a video arcade known for sex-seeking behaviors, they were less likely to trust that a partner was safe to sleep with versus if they met a partner through friends. So meeting or having sex at high-risk venues resulted in uncertainty and or anxiety over the partner's HIV risk. But again, this did not necessarily translate into their behaviors. So even if they were feeling anxious or uncertain, some men in the sample did sleep with these participants unprotected. I'd seen him before at the club, so I recognized him. When I saw him at a video arcade known to for sex-seeking behaviors, trying to smash, i.e. sleep, I thought about it for a long minute. He looked so good, so other dudes were probably trying to get on that. He was trying to use a condom with me, and maybe other people too. I don't know. I was concerned, but just went with it. And finally, participants describe behavioral cues for risk assessment. And these were used to ascertain whether they believed the person was clean, whether they believed the participant, the person was promiscuous or not. And after these, deciding, you know, should I in fact sleep with this person? Participants described if, for example, if they had a long-term partner, if their partner started acting differently or not acting right, participants would insist on condoms. This was usually based on suspicion that the partner was being unfaithful and sleeping around. And a lot of times this insistence on condom use was very short-lived despite ongoing suspicious behavior. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, I can't keep asking my boyfriend to use a condom. He thinks I don't trust him. When in a lot of cases the participant didn't trust their partners. If participants thought that a partner socialized at social venues too often, like if they saw them at a club on more than one occasion, they would make assessments about the participant's promiscuity and that the partner was not a safe sexual partner to sleep with. When I realized that he wasn't at the bar, you know, sometimes you go to the bar and you see someone every week, they party, they drink. He wasn't like that, not a hoe. So the risk factor went down. So this participant, basically, he did sleep with this partner based on the belief that because he doesn't see the prospective partner at a club or at a bar very often, that he's not a promiscuous person and in fact safe to possibly sleep with, which he did. Other behavioral cues described by participants were assessments of prospective partner's health routines. I didn't take his word on his HIV status. I watched how he was, what he did. I know how he is. I knew a former partner who was HIV positive, med routine, so I would see if this partner was trying to sneak something. But I wasn't there all the time. I would spend a weekend. And another participant said, I think he's safe of HIV. He doesn't take pills. He doesn't take no medication. At the end of the interview, when I said that there are some people that are HIV positive that don't, in fact, have to take medication, a lot of these participants got very, you know, a lot of them were shocked. A lot of them were like, I know, but that's the risk I'm taking. And so what we see from this data is that there's a clash between what participants know and what they do. And participants were very cognizant of this discrepancy. So they acknowledged flaws in their sexual risk assessment, with one saying, I mean, obviously it sounds stupid when you say it and when you think about it, but, and another said, so having the pleasure kind of override the intellectual cognitive is hard, but that's what occurred. So overall, we find discrepancies between reported personal beliefs and knowledge and participants' behaviors. And the cues, the location-based cues, the visual cues, the intuition, and the behavioral cues function both individually and interactively to guide risk assessment and sexual behaviors. So one, you know, rather innocuous cue on its own would not lead to having sex. Whereas when two work together, that might lead a participant to come to the decision that someone is in fact safe to sleep with. The following steps, we need a greater understanding of the visual and behavioral cues guiding sexual behaviors. This was a rather small study, so a larger study would be very beneficial. A fuller appreciation of the social cultural context of these cues and how they operate in men's everyday lives. Further qualitative research to understand why it is that men are using these cues to come to sexual behavior decisions, and culturally relevant models for addressing these risk assessment processes. And that's it. Thank you.